Quel est le point de métal?
Hello, wrestling fans, and welcome to Shut Up and Wrestle, a wrestling history podcast about good conversations and great stories. I am your host, Brian R. Solomon. This is episode 112, in which we venture to the Pacific Northwest for a conversation with Portland wrestling historian Mike Rogers. Mike's got a new book out, too. We're going to talk about that in the conversation. Before we get to that, a couple of quick things this week. Not a lot of beating around the bush, but I do have a couple things I wanted to touch on. First of all, I wanted to give you guys a quick update on Irresistible Force, The Life and Times of Gorilla Monsoon. Now, when I last mentioned it to you, I talked about how I was working on Chapter 6, which is a very important chapter because it covers Gorilla's first run in the Worldwide Wrestling Federation from 1963 to 65, which is pretty legendary. And I just wanted to say that now that I'm working on it and I'm actually wrapping that chapter up, that I think a lot of people are going to be very pleased because, you know, the problem with that era is there's really no footage available. It is impossible to watch Gorilla Monsoon in that mid-60s era of the WWWF and see what the legend was really all about. However, I'm proud to say, because of the kind of newspaper coverage that some of these matches got in the New York, New Jersey press in those days, that I'm really able to give some very detailed descriptions of some of these very important matches. And the two that I focus on specifically are the October 1963 Roosevelt Field match with Bruno Sammartino, which really kind of solidified Monsoon as a major star in wrestling. It was like his kind of like his coming out. And then also the May 1964 Madison Square Garden 70-minute time limit draw that still gets talked about to this day between Monsoon and Sammartino. I was able to really dig in deep on those matches and a few others too. I think people are going to love it. So I'm wrapping up Chapter 6. I'll continue to keep you guys posted as the progress of the book moves along. Also, you know, I don't do this enough, but I wanted to plug a couple of podcasts that I'm really enjoying right now, and I would suggest that you guys check out if you are not already checking it out. So first of all, in the Arcadian Vanguard Network, you may have heard of the show Stick to Wrestling with John McAdam. I know I'm a listener to that show every single week. I love it. And what John is doing this year with Steve Ginnarelli, week by week, is he's breaking down the national expansion of the WWF, which took place 40 years ago, 1984. And he's doing it month by month in real time on his show. And it is absolutely fascinating. I mean, granular down to the details of what was happening day to day, what shows were being put on. I can't wait till he gets to July, because that's when they brought the Iron Sheik versus Sergeant Slaughter to my elementary school gym in Brooklyn. And I'm hoping that it gets a mention on the show because the neighborhood was on fire thanks to the hottest feud in the country coming to our elementary school gym. So anyway, check it out if you haven't. Stick to Wrestling with John McAdam. Also, Bob Smith, who was a guest on this show, former editor at Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Bob's got a podcast called The Outdated Wrestling Hour. And you could tell already from the title of that show that I am a fan. And on the most recent episode, should be the most recent episode out now as you're listening to this, Bob has on his show as his guest, the one and only Supermouth Dave Drayson, a.k.a. Dave Brzezinski, the last manager of the original Sheik, and a man who was really instrumental in making Blood and Fire the excellent book that it turned out to be. So if you want to check that out, Bob Smith with Dave Brzezinski on the Outdated Wrestling Hour, a show worth checking out in general, but especially when he's got Supermouth on. Now, without further ado, let's look at my conversation this week, the very first episode of Spring 2024 for Shut Up and Wrestle. We open the windows, we let the air in for a fresh conversation on Portland Wrestling with Mike Rogers, and I'm going to take you to it right now. Okay, so it's my pleasure this week on Shut Up and Wrestle to welcome a guest to the show that's going to take us into an area where we don't normally go. And I'm talking about a geographical area being the Pacific Northwest and the Portland wrestling scene. It's one of the territories that doesn't get talked about enough, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that as part of this. But he is one of the people behind the Excitement in the Air Bulletin, which led to a series of interview books, and most recently was the co-author of Katie Bar the Door, The History of Portland Wrestling, and the brand new, which I have on my desk right in front of me, Encyclopedia of Portland Wrestlers. I'm talking about Mike Rogers. Mike, thanks so much for being a guest on the show.
Oh, Brian, thank you. I appreciate it very much.
So we were talking before we started just about the idea of, you know, how all of this started with you doing tons of interviews over the years for Excitement in the Air and then turning that into a series where you could share that with fans.
Sure. In about 1983, I started a bulletin called Ring Around the Northwest. And it started off 3 pages just on a typewriter, 50 cents. It was a lot of fun. It was really bad. As the years went along, I wanted to do more. And so I got up to about 10 pages and I would have an interview in just about every issue. And I was fortunate enough to interview some really, really top stars that had all always at least had a few matches in Portland. And so over those years, I interviewed Luthez, Don Leo Jonathan, Pompero Firpo, Bull Ramos, Dutch Savage, you know, Ivan Koloff, on and on. I was really fortunate enough. And that after the bulletin ended, after about 30 years in 2013, I thought, I'm sitting on these interviews and I think they're pretty good. And so I figured out that we should do a book or two on them. And so there's 3 volumes of Excitement in the Air.
That's great. And the encyclopedia is really exhaustive. It's wild. It's like you were saying how, you know, it's not just the people you would immediately think of when you think of that territory, you know, like a Dutch Savage or obviously Roddy Piper or Buddy Rose or whatever. It's literally everyone who was ever there practically is in here. Even people, like you said, like Luthez, who might have come through when he was defending the title and things like that, but isn't really identified with that territory. So, I mean, it's extensive. It's really impressive.
We've come up with one person that we accidentally left out, and I can't even remember who that was, but I think we did a pretty good job of getting just about every single wrestler who was in Portland.
There are even some funny ones in there where it's like, you know, you're even talking about enhancement guys, and it's like, they're pretty obscure. In some cases, the only evidence we have that these people existed is their name on a list of results, you know, from the Portland arena. And so sometimes you just have to kind of go with it and say, well, all we know about this guy is he wrestled 2 matches in Portland and that's about it.
Right. Exactly. And it's that was really fun trying to be a detective and trying to figure out some of those things. There's a great example. A lot of times the only record is Don Owen would call in the results to the newspaper. And if it wasn't on TV, that really became the official record. So as I'm going through results, here's a funny example. I see Frenchie Robiere, who was a preliminary wrestler in the Northwest in the early 60s. And this is 1973, and he's listed in a result. And he had homesteaded here for a while. But I thought that doesn't sound right. Frenchie Robiere. And so I looked him up in Wrestle Data, and he actually was in the Maritimes right at that same time. So then I said, okay, a lot of times guys who would be wrestling in Vancouver would come down to Portland to help fill out a card. And so I looked who was in Vancouver at that time, and Frenchie Martin was in Vancouver. And there was another wrestler, Wayne Bridges, who had come down. And I said, I'll bet this is Frenchie Martin, because when Don Owen starts to call in these results, he probably just wrote down Frenchie. And then he just said, remembered, you know, spaced out and said Frenchie Robiere. And so things like that are just a lot of fun to try to figure out.
Yeah, I love doing that kind of stuff too, where you come across something that maybe is sort of accepted fact, something that a lot of people have gone on just because it's on the internet somewhere. And then you really dig into it and you discover a mistake was made. You discover maybe where it was made or why it was made. Like, I'm having things like that happen right now with the Gorilla Monsoon book that I'm doing, because it's, you know, I'm writing about his very early career before he came to the WWF, because, you know, he was in Vancouver and he was in Stampede and things like that. And some of it is so obscure. And in some cases, as you know this way better than me, Cage Match or Wrestling Data, as great as they are, and I think Wrestling Data is even slightly better, they, even though it's not as user-friendly, they don't have everything, not even close, especially if you're talking about pre, I guess, 2000 or something. They're not going to have, and in some cases, I have to go into newspapers to really like show, because I'm looking at a gap and going, did this really happen? Or what was he doing this week? And I'll have to dig around newspapers. Thank God for the internet for that, and piece it together.
Right. It is. It's so much fun. Another example, there was a time period in Portland where there was a Pepe Villa, there was a Pancho Villa, and then there was a Pancho Lopez, and they're all within, you know, a couple months of each other, all working both Portland and Vancouver. And, you know, just a lot of fun trying to figure that stuff out.
So there's a fun fact. I think Pancho Lopez, if it's the same Pancho Lopez, I believe he also went by Ramon Lopez. And if that is the same person, who I think it is, he actually was the guy that wrestled Gorilla when he was just Bob Morella in his first match ever in the Rochester War Memorial in 1960.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then he brought him in years later as a jobber on WWF TV in the 70s. So it's like all these crazy connections, you know?
Yeah.
But the book is, first of all, you can't see this. So I mean, there's no point in holding it up because this is an audio only podcast, but it's enormous. I'm not advocating using it for a doorstop because it's great to read, but if you wanted to, you could, and it would do the trick.
It could hold back any door.
Yes, it really could. But see, I, like a lot of people, I find this territory fascinating because it's like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like an enigma because it lasted longer than almost any other territory. I think Don Owen has the record for the longest run of any promoter running any wrestling company. And I mean, it was started by his dad. So the Owen family, I mean, I think, and Portland Wrestling, I believe, even though it was a local broadcast, is still the longest running wrestling TV broadcast ever. Although I have a feeling in a few more years, Monday Night Raw will surpass it, but Portland Wrestling is the record. And yet, what I'm trying to say is we still don't hear as much about it as we should. And it lasted longer than almost any territory, right? I can think like 92 or something is when they finally closed up. And yet it's still seen as one of the more obscure territories.
The thing that helped Portland Wrestling was, it was such a tradition. It was so stable. Don Owen owned his own building, and so that definitely helped keep it going. The TV was so solid and so dependable. They used to run it live from 8:30 to 10, so you'd be seeing live. And then they pushed it back, so it came on 11 o'clock, but it was still the same night. And so the people who couldn't make it to the sports arena could still see, you know, most of the card of what was happening that night. And so such a tradition back in the 60s and even up into the 70s, for being a fairly big town, Portland was a small town. And there wasn't a lot of other things going on until the Trailblazers came into town. So the Portland wrestlers were really big in the town. Even if you weren't a wrestling fan, you would know something about Lonnie Mayne or Tony Bourne, or there'd be some obscure connection, like my brother's neighbor lives next to Lonnie Mayne. You know, everybody had a connection like that. And so the wrestlers, you know, became more very famous in the town, even if the people weren't fans.
It reminds me a little bit of Memphis in that way, or even just Tennessee wrestling in general, where you have an area which at the time had no professional sports and wrestling was the closest thing people had. And you hear about how, you know, it's like the highest rated show in the market and things like that. It's interesting how because as I talk about exhaustively on here, I grew up in New York City, so we had about 48,000 pro sports teams. So in order for wrestling to survive, it had to be almost like the biggest, hugest, most lucrative territory with the garden and everything. Because if it wasn't, it would have just been completely overshadowed. But in other places of the country, like wrestling was not only that, but wrestling was more, I don't want to say respectable. I don't know if I'd ever call it respectable, but it was not as, like, you know, John McAdam has talked about this on Stick to Wrestling on his show. If you were in the New York area as a wrestling fan, people kind of looked at you as a weirdo. They really did, unfortunately. But it wasn't like that everywhere. Like, I think in some of the southern territories, it wasn't as much of a stigma to be a wrestling fan. It was a little bit more accepted and mainstream. And I have a feeling it was probably a little bit more like that in Portland too.
Right. There was definitely a culture, like the results and the lineups were always in the newspaper. So that lends a little bit of credence to it being, you know, legitimate. You know, and I think in Portland, they really looked at it as a sport. You know, that was the overall, you know, people took it seriously. They cared what happened to the baby faces. And so, yeah, I think that that culture and that time period probably has had a lot to do with it. They treated it with respect.
Yeah. And I think what comes out too in the book with all the profiles and things and how spread out over time it is how, you know, so often when we hear about some of these territories, people really only talk about the last few years, you know, because that's what people remember. Like if you hear people talk about Crockett, they're really only talking about the period from when they came on TBS, like the last few years maybe of the territory, or Portland, obviously, I'll get there with that. But Memphis is another one. You only hear people talk about the later years of it. But when it comes to Portland, you'll hear people talk about Roddy Piper, of course. That's the name that always comes up, and you know, Jesse Ventura and things like that. But that was really the tail end. And your book gives an idea of just how long this was going for. Because like we said, it's one of the longest running territories ever, like predates television by decades. And so, you know, what we talk about and what you hear people talk about is really just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. You know, you mentioned in my book, Katie Bar the Door, The History of Portland Wrestling, we started at 1960. And that was, there's a lot went on before that, of course, but there really weren't going to be too many people who that caught their interest. And in 1960, there's still that early time, we had Nick Bockwinkel, Billy White Wolf, Pampero Firpo, Destroyer, so much great talent through the early 60s. But that time period's forgotten. You know, there's not starting to get so far in the past where,
yes,
not very much, like that's before my time. I don't remember. I was born in 1960, so I don't have any memories of that. The time period that really people will still remember and still tap into is about 1968, 69. And that was the Lonnie Mane, Tony Bourne era. And when people recall wrestling, they'll usually say Buddy Rose, Roddy Piper. Mm-hmm. And then if we'll go back far enough, it'll be Lonnie Mane, Tony Bourne. And then there was a lot of good stuff at the end when the Grappler took over from 87 on. It just changed the look of the show. Roddy Piper was involved, of course, in a lot of the booking and stuff and behind the scenes and upgrading how the TV show looked. So, there was a lot of different looks to Portland and a lot of different time periods that people will remember.
The Piper connection is really interesting because, you know, as a lot of people know with Roddy Piper, Roddy Piper did what Roddy Piper wanted. Nobody was going to tell him what to do, what he could or couldn't do. He was a man unto himself. And so not many people would have done what he did in the sense that he remained loyal to Don Owen. He remained loyal to the promotion. He wouldn't run against it. If Don Owen needed him, he would go and work shows. There are a lot of guys that wouldn't have had the nerve to ask Vince McMahon if they could do that, number one. And then there were people who may have had the nerve to ask, but Vince McMahon would have told them no. But Roddy Piper, that was not the case. He got to do what he wanted to do. I mean, the idea of not just a WWF wrestler, but one of the biggest and most recognized, going back there and humbly going back there and remembering his roots. It's one of those things that just makes Roddy Piper such a well-remembered person in wrestling, you know?
Right. And I know you touched on it when WWF started coming into Portland, almost on a monthly basis, Piper didn't want to work any of their shows because he felt it would be in competition with Don Owen. And that was definitely a show of loyalty to Don Owen. And Don Owen appreciated it too. Here's a funny story. I once tried to do an interview with Don Owen. And I mailed him some questions, and I had sent him my bulletin very naively, thinking that Don Owen is just going to love this. And I called him, and after I'd sent the thing, and he goes, "You're the guy who keeps sending this." You know, Don's cranky and old. "You're the guy who keeps sending me this gosh darn bulletin." And he goes, and then I go, "Yeah, you know, I'm just hoping to get an interview with you." And he goes, "All right." He goes, "Mail it." I think I'd already mailed it. He goes, "Mail it. You know, I'll have a look at it." You know, just so grumpy. And then he did it. He filled out a little bit, you know, nothing extensive, but filled it out. And I had asked him about Piper and coming back to work the big 60th anniversary show. Mm-hmm. Piper came back when he was working for WWF. He wrote down, he said, "Piper is loyal and he always will be, or always seems to be loyal, and he'll help me out whenever he can." So kind of from Don Owen's words as well.
That's great. And there's a clip, and I don't know if it's from that show or something around that time. It's actually very funny, where Piper is taking questions from fans or something like that. And somebody asked him, you know, this is the era of 100% kayfabe, because Piper was beloved in Portland, but he was not in the WWF. So someone asked him about that. A fan was like, why are you doing these things in the WWF? Why are you being so mean? And Roddy had to come up with some kind of clever response of how, you know, he didn't like the people in New York. They thought they were better than us here in Portland, or something like that. And I'm trying to stick it to them and show them that, you know, and take them down a notch. Like, he had this answer that totally fit. It didn't break kayfabe, and it satisfied this fan that couldn't understand, we love you, why are you such a bad guy on this national wrestling show that we all could see, you know?
Sure.
That's great. But he, you know, he got his start there, and he never forgot it. It's like, even people still talk about that to this day. That was the place where he first really got to shine and got to be the Roddy Piper that we would remember. Is that where he did the bottle over the head thing, or was that in California? I can't remember.
I think he definitely did it in Vancouver. There was
Vancouver.
A, a time period where, and I think he did it in Portland as well. There was a time period where Portland and Vancouver were so intermixed, it was almost like they were one promotion. And all the top guys would go up there as well. Al Tomko always promoted, but there was just that portion of time where they were using all the Portland guys, and it just became one big territory.
Right, right. And I think they would, well, I didn't realize he did that more than once. That's brutal. For people that don't know, it's what I'm talking about is there's a promo where Piper legitimately breaks a glass bottle, like a beer bottle, over his head in the middle of a promo and just starts bleeding like a pig. I mean, it's horrifying, but it's a very well-known clip. I'll probably wind up putting it on the Facebook group or something, but the idea that he did it more than once, my God.
And it's interesting too. You know, you kind of look in and see what the openings are when guys come into the territory, or who has just left or who is going to leave. And when Piper came in, he came in the same day as Killer Brooks, and Buddy Rose and Waskowski at that time were mostly in, they were working California as well. My gut feeling is that I don't know if Roddy Piper was slotted to be one of the top guys. And obviously there's nobody better at getting himself over than Roddy Piper. But having four top, you know, Rose and Waskowski were already established. Brooks, obviously, with his look, is going to be at the top of the cards. And so I really don't know if, you know, Don Owen thought that Piper was going to be one of his main guys, at least initially.
Oh, that's interesting. I wrote a lot about Killer Brooks, actually, in my Sheik book, because the Sheik had really helped get him going in Detroit. He was kind of like, even though Killer Brooks was from Texas, he really got some of his first breaks in the Detroit territory. He was an interesting guy. I actually spoke to him for that book right before he passed away. He was very sick, but he had a lot of great memories. He was really great to talk to.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to have an interview with him as well. And the thing that he got the biggest kick out of was when Rose and Waskowski split with Brooks and Piper. He said it's the only time he's ever been a babyface anywhere ever. And that was in Portland, you know,
yeah,
alongside Piper.
It's hard for people that know what he looks like. It'd be hard to have him be, you know, it would be like Bruiser Brody, although Brody did work as a face, but it would be like somebody like that being a face, not a natural baby face, let's just say.
Right.
Did you find that, because I know, for example, with California on the West Coast, there would always be a lot of a connection with Hawaii and Japan. Guys would make that crossing and they would stop over in one place or another. Did that carry over in the Northwest too, or was it too far north to be a factor? Like, would guys be coming back from Japan or Hawaii and make a stop there typically, or vice versa?
Every now and then, but Portland wasn't as lucky as Hawaii.
Right.
Right. I think mainly it would be because I don't think Portland was a big hub for that. But there was occasion, I know Keith Hart stopped off in Seattle and worked a show or two. And I think he was the only Hart ever to work in the North, in Portland. But I asked him about that. I said, was this really you that came to Seattle? And he said, yeah, I stopped when I was coming back from Hawaii. It almost had to be a conscious, like, hey, let's stop in the Northwest, you know, on the way right back home.
Right, because it was a little more out of the way. It also didn't have weather as nice as California and things like that. But, you know, and now that I have you here, actually, this reminds me of something. I can ask you now live to tape, and try to get some information on this. But I had read somewhere, because this is while I'm working on this Gorilla Monsoon book, that Gorilla, before he became Gorilla, had very briefly stopped off in the Northwest, I think, when he was coming back from Japan, right before he went to work for the McMahons for the very first time. Someone had said that he did this very briefly, and that he worked heel, and that he was trying to kind of get, you know, get a little warmed up before he went into New York. but I cannot find any results or evidence of this happening. Did you ever see his name pop up at all in Portland results?
I don't think he ever worked Portland. He did work Vancouver.
Yes.
Very, very limited, but I don't believe he ever worked Portland.
I saw a main event that he had against Luthez in Vancouver, where when he had been working for Stu Hart in Calgary, he was on the undercard on a few shows where Thez was in the main event. And I think I get the feeling that Thez must have got a look at him and said, 6'6", 350 pounds, NCAA finalist, AAU finalist. I think I'd like to work with this guy, and brought him up to Vancouver for at least one main event where obviously Thez won. But I think that was the connection of getting Monsoon, who at the time was Gino Morella, but getting him into Vancouver for a couple of shots. I think it was that Thez connection.
Right. And that Vancouver during that time period throughout the 60s, early 60s, they rotated guys in and out really quickly. I don't know if it's because they didn't want to stay in Vancouver, or if that was just the formula. You know, they'd come in for a month, like Bill Watts. He came in for a month, Waldo Von Erich, guys like really top guys. They'd come in and just have really short stays.
My impression with that territory is that it seems like the kind of place where they really had to rely on other offices to get their talent. You know what I mean? Like Houston was, where places like that, where they didn't really have their own booking office. They had to get wrestlers maybe from the surrounding territories. And that might be why it was a place where people just came and went so quickly, because it wasn't really looked at as a full-time place so much. I mean, that's just the impression I get.
When Rod Fenton ran Vancouver before Sander Kovacs and Gene Kaninsky took over, and when Kaninsky and Kovacs took over, then it's kind of settled in and guys would stay a little bit longer, it would seem like, and then it was more of a traditional territory. What I mentioned there in the early 60s, it looked more like Hawaii, where guys would come in and have really short stints.
Right. When did I know that Kaniski and Kovacs came in? That was probably had to be like the mid 60s or late 60s.
Don't know the exact year, but I'm going to guess right about 65, 64.
Okay. That's interesting, because Kovacs, I'm not going to make this whole show about Gorilla Monsoon, but it just happens to be what I'm working on. But Kovacs was his trainer. He was the guy that first broke him in upstate New York. Because he at that time was booking for Pedro Martinez, and he kind of got him going. And I think he helped get him other shots here and there, but he wouldn't have been in Vancouver at that time. So, because then that would have made sense of why Gino was in Vancouver. But I guess that timing doesn't really match up. Yeah, but we won't just talk about Gorilla Monsoon, as I promised, because there's so many other people in this book. Now, the way that you put this together, was it drawing on all the work that you had done in the past on finding information on these guys, or was a lot of it brand new research that you had to do?
I'm going to say probably about half of it was brand new research, just to check if they're still alive, and things like that. I always thought it was interesting to kind of check where they came from and where they went right after they left as well. And then some of the guys, I was able to draw a little bit of snippets if I'd interviewed them before. So I thought that always lended, you know, a little bit of interest into their biography, you know, some of their own words.
Now, I have to mention this before I forget. Your editor, collaborator, Frank Culbertson, he mentioned to me before we started that I should ask you about an incident when you were a kid where you went into the ring to try to make a three count because the referee, I guess, was incapacitated or whatever. Can you confirm that this happened?
Sure. I lived in a little town called Seaside, and it's a coastal town about 100 miles from Portland, and they'd have matches monthly. And the one thing that when the heat would come in Seaside. A little bit of surprise. There was no barricades or anything. It was pretty common, especially at the very end. Fans would come around the ring, you know, if they were setting something up and pound on the mat. Well, during a match, I can remember where the heat was going, and I'm sure the referee was distracted, and I was sitting in front row, and I have virtually no memory. I didn't get into the ring, but I went up to the apron, and there was a pin going on, and the referee was counting, and I counted three, and I walked back to my seat, and I was sitting with a buddy, and his eyes were big. My eyes were big. I have no memory of making that move. So that's.
Do you know who was wrestling? Did anybody know?
I cannot remember. It would have been the mid 70s. So possibly the Kangaroos, the Royal Kangaroos, Snuka.
That's great. That's great. And you know what's great about that too? What was the name of the town again?
Seaside.
All right. So, and because I, you know, you saw this everywhere. I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn, which was a borough of New York City. It's not, you know, Manhattan. It's not, you know, it's like almost as far from the Garden as where you lived was from the Portland Arena. I mean, it's not, New York City is a big place, but in all these little nooks and crannies, we would get these shows that had major, major stars on them. So like when people talk about, you know, comparing it, let's say independent wrestling of today to the territories, it's not quite the same thing. It really isn't, because these little towns and little venues and little armories and things, because they were affiliated with major territorial promotions, they would be getting the top flight. I mean, not top to bottom on the card, but you would be getting major stars that you'd read about in magazines, people that you'd see, you know, or even in the days of, let's say, when Georgia Championship Wrestling would be on national cable and you could see those people on national TV, then you'd see them on occasion come to your local place. And that was an incredible thing to see. I just got a little taste of it, but I'd be in my little elementary school gym in Brooklyn and sitting and going, I can't believe these are the guys I see on Saturday mornings. This guy, I'm looking at, you know, Nikolai Volkoff or whoever, or you know, the Killer Bees, and I'm going, they were just in the Pontiac Silverdome in front of, you know, whatever, 80,000, 90,000 people. And now here they are in the gym where I have gym class, you know, in school in front of a few hundred people. Like, that's something that people today sometimes don't understand what it was like, you know?
Right. So Seaside's a town of about 5,000, and they would have wrestling monthly. And starting about sixth grade or so, that's when I started going every show. But the exciting thing was, as I'd walk home from school, about 2 to 3 weeks before the show, there'd be window posters. And as my love of wrestling, it would be like, always as we're driving through town, I'm always scanning the stores for the window posters for the new, you know, for the new show that was coming. And I can't even describe how exciting that was to run over and have a look at that window poster to see what matches were coming. And I always thought it was interesting. I can remember this one show. They had listed the card, and Manny Cruz was on the card. And we hadn't even seen, Manny Cruz hadn't even arrived in the territory yet. And I'm 12. How do they know he's going to be here? He's not even around yet, you know? And so I always remember that. And you know, that should have been a little bit of a glimpse that it really is a business, you know?
Right, right. Well, when I... I had, like I said, this little venue, this little youth center. And, you know, when I was starting to watch wrestling, it really was, this stuff was almost at its very, very end, these smaller buildings and smaller promotions. And I think, you know, I was there for the last one when the WWF would stop sending talent to those little tiny little places and high school gyms and things. So I missed most of it, but I can remember even in my neighborhood, we had on the street corner where the church was there, because it was a Catholic school youth center, there was this gigantic telephone pole And that's where they would staple and tack the wrestling posters to. And so I would see them now and then, even before I knew what it was. And I remember later on when I really was into it and I was a fan, they had stopped running the shows, but they still had one of the posters. It must have been on there for like 10 years. I'm not even kidding. 10, 12 years. And it was crumbling to nothing and pieces of it were missing, but I would walk by and I would try to read the names on it. And it's funny now, you know, I'm 49 years old. 10 years now is like the blink of an eye, you know, but at that time it was like finding the Rosetta Stone, like something from some ancient time. And I'm going, okay, Rick Martel and Tony Garea versus Mr. Fuji and Mr. Saito. Wow, like I think I know who those guys were, and you know, like that kind of thing, just piecing it together and just catching the tail end of it. I really wish I'd been around like you to catch more of those small local shows, but I missed most of it.
Somebody in one of the wrestling sites that I just saw posted a newspaper clipping from my hometown, Seaside, but it was from 1963. So it's nothing I have any memories of, but you know, you find it fascinating because, oh, look, and it was six guys, a battle royal, and obviously three single matches, you know, and it's like Abe Jacobs and Luther Lindsay and Tony Bourne and before my time, but fascinating, you know.
Yeah. Or you would hear, you know, maybe older fans or friends or family members that would say to you, oh, I remember this guy or that guy, and it would be before your time. But because you would hear them talk about those people, it made them more real to you and, you know, more alive to you, things like that.
The very first match I ever went to was probably about 1968. And the card, so I've pieced this together. The midgets were in the territory. And so when the midgets came, they were able to have two cards the same night in different places. So they'd split the crew. So I remember the main event, Tony Bourne had just turned. So the main event was Tony Bourne and Luigi Massera versus Bad Boy Shields. It was Bull Belinsky and Soldat Gorky. Soldat Gorky was an old timer, hadn't been on TV, and he was in this main event in my hometown. So my grandpa took me to the matches. When we got home, we were telling my mom about the matches, and we said Soldat Gorky was there. He was the guy in the main event. And she's like, oh no, did he use the claw? And it's like, Soldat Gorky was so over with me at that point because he must have been awesome. And I wished he'd seen him use the claw, you know?
Yeah, for people who remember, right? I mean, like it sticks in people's memories. I remember when I became a fan, you know, and this would have been the late 80s, and I had a great aunt, my grandmother's sister, who, you know, never watched wrestling. She didn't know a lot about wrestling. And the minute that she heard that I was watching wrestling, you know, we were Italian, she goes, oh, Antonino Rocca. I remember Rocca. And he used to fly through the air and do all these drop kicks and things. And I would go, Aunt Jenny, I think that I don't think he's around anymore. You know, I think that was a little before my time, but she still remembered the name and it still meant something to her, you know? But the thing I wanted to ask you too about Portland, and I'm sure you've, you know, written about this or thought about it, is one of the things that was so impressive was that it was able to last for so long. And I think that's one of the things that it's known for. It was one of the last of the true territories to exist. And I think Memphis probably has the record for being the very last, unless you count Puerto Rico, which is still going to this day, but on the mainland. And there's reasons for that, right? I mean, like you said, Don Owen owned the building, so that helped. I believe he probably had a lot of friends with the Athletic Commission and things like that, so that might have helped. But what do you think really helped them to keep going so long?
Definitely the tradition, because like I mentioned before, Portland Wrestling just had this tradition. They were up to date because you could see what was going on that night on TV. And that, I think that helped a lot because you were right up to date with what was going on. The stability of the TV and, you know, that when that ended, when WWF took over their TV time slot, that was something I never thought would happen as a Portland wrestling fan. I said, they'll go on forever because he owns the building. You know, when Don Owens' son was into promoting, you know, there's a whole nother generation ready to take over. So that those three things, the tradition, the TV, and he owned his main Portland building. That's what lends to the longevity of Portland wrestling.
So was there, like you said, was there a sense maybe among the fans and the people who were regulars and who've been watching it for years, like you're watching all these dominoes fall, especially if you're a fan that's really following what's going on, or, you know, you're reading magazines, or let's say, God forbid, you even were a newsletter reader at the time, right? And you get what's going on. It's in the air, like, oh my God, all these companies are folding, or WWF is going in these towns where they never were. But that's not going to happen here. Like we're a fortress. That's not going to. And for a while, it seemed like that was right, because it was kind of like, it was kind of like this little corner, this little pocket of the wrestling universe that didn't seem to be getting affected by what was going on everywhere else.
Right. There was a time period, 85, 86, 87, where it was bad. The booking was really, really bad. And the talent was on a downhill slide. The wrestlers tried, there were good wrestlers, but there wasn't that time period where you had Piper and Martel and the Sheepherders and Rose and Moskowski, and it was just great top to bottom. For a while, you had Tully Blanchard and Gino Hernandez. They were on the undercards. They were in the preliminaries. But you hit 86 and early 87, and you had Coco Samoa and Ricky Santana and Brady Boone. And those guys are great, but they probably shouldn't have been in the main events.
Yeah. I think great might be very kind, but they were, you know, they were skilled, that's for sure.
Right.
You know?
Right. Then in September of 87, they made a booking change and Grappler came in with lots of new ideas, you know, other connections and stuff. And so there was a resurgence in Portland wrestling from that point. And that Piper was in there in the back also, helping out, upgrading the ideas. And so from 87 to 91, things were looking great. And there wasn't enough smart fans to know what was going on, even in 91, 92. But when they lost TV, then that was a big slap in the face, you know, as far as, oh, how are we going to know if we don't go, how are we going to know what's going on in
right. Portland? Because they lost the sponsor, right? Isn't that what happened?
Sponsor had the loss of Tom Peterson. He was the sponsor all the years. They lost him at just about the same time, and WWE replaced the TV show. And then it was like, you know, you didn't want to see it, but you could see the writing on the wall that things were definitely changing. Crowds went down immediately. You know, they on a bad night there'd be 1,000. On a good night there'd be 3,000, and then when they lost TV 2 weeks later, it was down to about 200.
Wow!
And they
Don ran
6 more months before he called it, and then Sandy Barr just took over. It was seamless. There wasn't a no wrestling, but he took over immediately and. He got on like middle of the night on a CBS affiliate. And I think he had another show on a public access show, and he did his best, but never the same.
If there's anything that shows you the power of television and how important it is to wrestling, I mean, that's it right there. And I mean, look, and that's why, you know, we talk about when these territories were dying, right? And the types of, let's say one, they still had TV, but were dying, the types of crowds that they would get that was considered a bad crowd. It would be an independent promoter's dream to have a crowd that big, right? Mm-hmm. But that, you know, like in Kobo Arena when the Sheik was going downhill and they'd be putting like 3,000 people in the building, and that meant, hey, we're going out of business soon, you know, because that was a 12,000, 13,000 seat arena. But that's television. You need, and that's the reason, like 90% of indies don't have any kind of television presence, and especially if you take out live streaming on the internet. And so they only draw a few hundred people at a time, typically. The impact of television, I mean, God, what that number you just, you're talking about a, something, it sounded to me like something like a 90% loss of the audio, of the live audience in 2 weeks. I mean, catastrophe.
Right, exactly. And Portland was, you know, unique, you know, it, and we talked about how there just wasn't lots and lots of entertainment going on. Their shows were weekly. And then about once a month, they'd have a special show on a Tuesday. So they were running 5 to 6 shows in Portland a month. And every once in a while, they'd sneak in another Tuesday. So maybe there'd be 2 Tuesday night shows in a month.
And from what I gather, too, I mean, it was, there were a lot of regulars, right? A lot of people were, that were there all the time for years, and people knew other people, and you just knew who was going to be there and that kind of a thing, which we see in a lot of other places too. But I mean, that helps keep it going too, is that it's a tradition. It's like almost like having season tickets to something, you know?
Well, that's exactly right. The people in Portland, they, it was the same people, you know, they must've had like season tickets around like the first 3 rows. And then there would be a big thing. If somebody passed away, somebody got a chance to move up a row, and you know, that was the only way you were sitting in the first 3 rows at, in Portland.
That
you
is could, crazy. You
just show up and say, I'd like to sit ringside. That just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I remember there being, you know, in Madison Square Garden, there were definitely regulars and things like that, and people that you'd see, or that even if you were just watching it on TV, you would recognize them, but it wasn't as close knit of a thing. I don't think it ever was, as in a market like Portland, where I'm, you know, it was just much more of a almost like a family oriented thing, just like a thing that you do with your family.
Exactly.
Yeah. So for people that want to know how to get the book, what's the best way to find it? And again, it's called The Encyclopedia of Portland Wrestlers.
It's, all my books are on Amazon. The first 3 are called Excitement in the Air, and those are interview books. I had mentioned, I think the first volume 1 has, the highlights are Luthez and Don Leo Jonathan, Bull Ramus, Dutch Savage. There's about 30. Brian Danielson is in volume 1. Volume 2 has Rick Martel, Ivan Koloff, Mad Dog Vachon, Don Jardine, Bad News Allen, Nick Wayne. Volume 3 has The Grappler, Mike Miller, Earl Maynard, Gary Royal, Haru Suzuki, Tony Bourne. You know, one of the things in the interview series that I found, I'm always super happy when I get the big names, but a lot of times, you know, the undercard guys, the preliminary guys have just a great story, you know, as the main eventers. And Gary Royal has a great story, great interview, you know, and he's a preliminary wrestler, mostly known for his work at Central States and Mid-Atlantic. And he came to Portland, and Don Owen has a pretty good reputation with almost everybody you talk to.
That's true.
And for some reason, it did not work out for Gary Royal. He was not promised he did not receive what he was promised. I think he showed up and he was a little bit smaller than what Don was expecting. And he just did not have a good time, and he did not give his notice, and he left. And the interesting part is he did not wrestle for about almost a year. He just got totally blackballed from the business, and he started wrestling with a mask in Mid-Atlantic and kind of easing his way back in. But that's a part it's interesting. You know, it's unfortunate. I thought Gary Royal, I saw Gary Royal have a fantastic match in Kansas City. Yeah, it's just like some of the preliminary guys have just as good stories as the main eventers.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've talked about it before, how one of the things, too, about the way the business was set up back then is you could have guys that could make a perfectly respectable middle class living, not have to have a quote unquote day job, wrestling for years, who were not even stars or huge names in the business. They just made their way around from place to place and made a decent, okay living. And that's something we do not have anymore.
Right, right. There's one wrestler in the Encyclopedia of Portland Wrestlers, Kenny Ackles, A-C-K-L-E-S, old timer. And I looked him up on Wrestle Data. He literally wrestled his way around the country like three times. He had a long, long career, 30 years, and he'd hit four territories a year. And he was here in the early 70s, and I looked, and he'd been in Portland in like the 50s, you know, literally just wrestled his way around the country two or three times, you know, and just like what you mentioned, you know, I don't think he ever had a title that whole time, you know, 20, 25 years. And yeah, just, you know, he probably had a little traveling bug in him, and he enjoyed doing that.
And that would be great for guys that weren't really attached. Let's say you didn't have a family or you didn't have anybody waiting for you. And so you could just live this itinerant lifestyle, this nomadic life. Or even in some cases, you might have guys who did have families and things. And maybe in some cases they would homestead and they would just be known for one area. But again, not huge names, maybe, you know, kind of known in their area, but not major stars or main eventers. They would, to them, it was just a job. You just went to work, did your job, came home, and that was that.
Exactly. Exactly.
And go on.
I'm sorry. We started to plug the books. The next book is Katie Bar the Door. It's the history of Portland wrestling. And that's kind of just a timeline starting at 1960. And we hit all the highlights, try and talk about everybody that comes in. That's a good one. I'm really proud of how that turned out.
I think that's probably the one that is the most popular, I would think, because that's the one I've heard the most talk about, because it's also, I think, we don't really have a book like that. I mean, that breaks down that territory in that way. It's probably the only one, although there is a great, there's a great radio show. I think I don't want to get this wrong because I'm recording this, but it's part of Dave Meltzer's Observer network. Yeah.
Jim Valley.
Right. I'm sorry, Jim. Jim, I have to have you on this show. First of all, because I forgot your name for like 20 seconds, which I should never do. But yes, Jim Valley does that show. Right.
Right.
And you mentioned the thing with Don Owen, with Gary Royal, because it's interesting to me that I would have to say all the stories I've ever heard and all the interviews I've read and all the books, I think Don Owen might have the best reputation of any wrestling promoter who ever lived. I mean, I can't think of, because even certain ones you hear, there'll be some good things about them. Some people like some, there are some that everybody hated, you know, like a Nick Gulas or something. And you just hear all a Roy Shire, everyone hate. But then there'll be people like Vince Sr. who a lot of people liked. But then some people weren't that crazy about. And I know Bruno didn't. And if Bruno says he wasn't that great, then that carries a lot of water. But with someone like Don Owen, man, I mean, as far as payoff and fairness and everything, he seems to be the high watermark of that. Not all wrestling promoters are lowlifes, you know?
Right. Yeah. There's a couple people who I've interviewed. Rocky Montero is not very complimentary. And Gary Royal had that problem, but the majority always have good things to say. It's interesting because Don Owen didn't really do much of his booking. In fact, for a long, long time, he didn't have a booker. It would be like just the top guys talking amongst themselves and figuring out what was going to happen, what was going to go on next week. And so he, you know, he I think that helped make him popular because everybody had a say in what was going on. He's always been described as a decent payoff guy, even though you might get your payoff in $1 bills or a roll of quarters. That wasn't uncommon, but I guess there's enough singles where it would be okay.
Well, for some people, because obviously payoff is going to be a big factor in whether wrestlers like you or not. And most wrestling promoters were not known for being that generous, you know. But sometimes you'd hear stories where, like, for example, again, with the Sheik, who had his own territory, you know, and he was a promoter and he was a wrestler. But if you talked to the handful, and they're not even alive anymore, but if you heard interviews and things with the handful of people that were really on top, let's say, they loved him. And they would say, oh, man, he paid me really well. I don't know what these guys are talking about. That's great, but that's because you're Bobo Brazil. You know what I mean? For most of the guys, they did not like him. And they thought, I mean, Les Thatcher told me that he was on vacation. Well, he was visiting his family in Cincinnati and he got lured into working a show for the Four Hots. And like 3 months later or something, they mailed him a check for $20. And he said, I'm never doing that again. I was visiting my family. You know, I went to go do this and this is what I get. But that's because he was an undercard wrestler. So in some cases, I think it depends where you were on the card, whether you thought it was a good payoff or not.
Sure.
Not everybody shared the wealth, you know?
Right.
Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough. This is great because I like to get to talk about topics and areas of wrestling history that I don't often get to do on here. And I always make a joke out of it, but I don't know how many shows I could do about the WWF in the 1980s. You know what I mean? Like there's only so many. So I like doing shows like this. This has been a pleasure. And, you know, I love the new book, Encyclopedia of Portland Wrestlers. It's like right up my alley, the kind of book that I can just get lost in it and just, you know, lose an hour or two just reading all these great capsule profiles and things. So, and I think a lot of people that listen to this will enjoy it too.
Thank you so much. I'll mention one more thing.
Yeah.
I've read just about everything on Portland that I think I can. I can't even come up with another Portland book or another idea for a Portland book. So I'm looking at Hawaii. Oh. And oh my gosh, I've jumped into that. And so interesting. You know, you see the results from the late 60s and the early 70s. And we mentioned earlier how they would pick up guys as they're on their way to and on the way back from Japan. And I was fortunate enough to interview Ed Francis and Lord Blears.
Oh, wow.
And so I have the background a little bit of Hawaii from their perspectives. And I grilled Lord Blears, you know, how your cards were so fantastic. You know, what was it like to book that? You know, and I worded it several times different ways to the point where he started to get annoyed with me as far as he kept saying, well, it was the local guys that drew the house. It would be like Ripper Collins, King Curtis, Sam Steamboat, those guys. And essentially he was like, it didn't matter if Baba and Wilbur Snyder and Gene Kaninsky happened to be on the card as well. It was Ripper Collins and Jim Hady and those guys that drew the card. And it took a long time, as now as I've gone through week by week, just like I did with Portland, I understand what he meant, because Wilbur Snyder on a stop by wasn't drawing anything for the house. It made the card great,
right? You know, once you were in the door. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's so true, because it was so local at the time that the fans in one area, certain names didn't mean that much to them if they hadn't seen them.
No. And so as I've gone back in the history too, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to be taking up too much
time. No. This is cool, because I would love to see something like that on the Hawaii territory. I have to tell you, it's funny to me. I think about way more than any normal person should think about. When I think about what it must have been like back then for these guys working these territories, I just think about how much fun it must have been to work that one. That had to be the one that people just most wanted to do. I mean, you just hang out on the beach in Hawaii. It's a wrestler's life to begin with, which is wild and crazy. Plus, you add the fact that you're in Hawaii. And then, yeah, you know, for like 20 minutes, you have to like get in the ring and wrestle. And then you can go back to having fun. I mean, it must have been a ball. I just recently interviewed Maureen Morella. Sorry, again, Gorilla Monsoon's widow. And she said they lived there in the summer of 69 because Gorilla had been working so much in Japan and Hawaii that they just decided, hey, let's just live here for a couple of months and then we'll go back to New York. And she goes to me, she's showing me all these photos of them on the beach and everything. And she goes to me, boy, what a lazy lifestyle it is out there. What a lazy way to live your life. It wasn't really wasn't for me, you know, but I'm thinking in my head, that would be for me.
Yeah. And I just looked up a quote from Thez, because he worked in Hawaii a lot, you know, just quick little trips. And his quote was, oh, you know, it was great. You might only you'd make $1,000 and spend 500. So you weren't going there for the money. But, you know, it was a great place to, you know, stop by and spend some time for sure.
Yeah, I bet. So we'll be on the lookout for that. Now you've got me interested. Well, I'll have to have you back once that comes out. Whatever comes out of that research, I'll have you back here and we'll talk Hawaii.
Absolutely.
There you have it, folks. My conversation with Mike Rogers. Mike, thanks so much for agreeing to be on the show for this, the first episode of spring for Shut Up and Wrestle. And as we spring forward week to week, please do keep listening to the show. Next week's episode, it's going to be an interesting one because my guest is a man whose work you may be aware of, whose efforts you may be benefiting from. His name, well, the name he goes by, is Chris P. Lettuce, and he is responsible for curating a vast amount of vintage wrestling footage that many of us enjoy on a regular basis. He's got a great perspective. He doesn't do many podcast appearances, but he's going to be on this one next week. So make sure you're listening. Other future guests to the show for WrestleMania week, I'm going to be having a roundtable of former WWE employees talking about the culture of the company, corporate-wise, on the road, etc., in light of all the Vince McMahon stuff and a lot of other topics. It's going to be an inside view like you've never heard before. That's coming WrestleMania week. Also, in the weeks to come, I have wrestling journalist and reporter Dominic D'Angelo. I have my friends, the hosts of the Whip Show podcast, and fellow Pro Wrestling Illustrated colleague Candace Cordelia among the many guests on their way to Shut Up and Wrestle in the weeks to come. So do keep listening. You can find us in so many places. There's our website, suawpod.com. And in addition to that, you can find it in all the usual places. Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, Podbean, you know the rest. Check it out. And while you're at it, join our Facebook group, Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. And if you would like to be among those cherished souls who have contributed financially to this otherwise free podcast, I encourage you to do so. You can go to my Twitter profile, Brian R. Solomon. There's a button there with a little dollar symbol on it if you want to contribute via Cash App or Venmo. If you'd like to use PayPal, you can find me at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. Also, if you'd like to purchase any of my books, signed copies of my books, you can also get me at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. And I'm talking about Blood and Fire, the unbelievable real-life story of wrestling's original Sheik, and Superheroes, the history of a pop culture phenomenon from Ant-Man to Zorro. You can also get plain old unsigned copies at Amazon or wherever you purchase books. If they don't have it, ask them to order it. The wrestling news from Arcadian Vanguard, your go-to stop every morning for all the news in the wrestling business. Check it out at thewrestlingnews.com or on the YouTube page for Arcadian Vanguard. The magazines that I write for, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, Check it out at pwi-online.com. Inside the Ropes magazine, check it out at insidetheropesmagazine.com. If you're looking for me on social media, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Brian R. Solomon. You can find my author page on Facebook at Brian Solomon Writer. And on any of those social media platforms, you will find the link to my author website on the World Wide Web. Shut Up and Wrestle is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And as always, this has been Brian R. Solomon asking you to keep those cards and letters coming in and reminding you that you can't wake up if you don't fall asleep. So long, wrestling fans.